While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On the Radio News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju. Now, today is Friday, the 26th of June, 2026, and as Namibia moves further into the second half of the year, the pace of change across our nation continues to accelerate, from economic development and policy reforms to technological innovation and emerging investment opportunities. The decisions being made today will definitely shape our country's future for the years to come. This right here is On the Radio News Analysis, a program dedicated not only to reporting the news, but also to helping you understand what lies behind the headlines. Every major development carries broader implications. Every policy decision affects businesses, communities, and households. Every emerging trend offers valuable insight into where Namibia may be heading. Our mission is to unpack those connections and provide the context needed to make sense of the issues shaping our nation. Now, on the radar, we take a closer look at the key developments driving businesses and the economy. We explore the policy decisions influencing national development, and we examine how innovation, entrepreneurship, and digital transformation are creating new opportunities, particularly for Namibia's young people. Now, we connect the decisions being made in government, industry, and the private sector with the realities experienced in homes, in classrooms, in workplaces, and communities across the country. Because understanding the bigger picture is not a luxury, it is an essential necessity. Now, beyond our borders, the world remains in a period of profound transformation. Geopolitical developments, changing trade relationships, climate resilience, energy security, technological disruptions, and the rapid growth of artificial intelligence continue to reshape economies and societies across the globe. Now, whether you're listening from Windhoek, Walvis Bay, Swakopmund, Oshakati, Rundu, Ketmanshu, Katimamulilo, Rudets, Gobabis, or anywhere else across Namibia, or perhaps you're joining us online from around the world, thank you for making us part of your Friday afternoon. Over the next 1 hour and 30 minutes, expect thoughtful analysis, informed perspectives, and conversations that go beyond the surface of today's headline. Now, let's get right into today's conversation. The city of Windhoek has taken another step towards strengthening the capital's resilience by launching its Disaster Risk Reduction Strategy and Action Plan, a framework designed to improve the city's ability to prevent and prepare for, as well as respond to and recover from disasters. Now, joining us in studio right now is Mr. Ngolombe Paulus. He is a disaster risk reduction specialist. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Paulus, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon to you. Good afternoon to your listeners. It's good to be here.
Definitely. Pleasure to have you. Also joining us in studio is Ms. Anna Marie Nipare, Section Head, Disaster Risk Management. Pleasure to have you with me.
Good afternoon, Juju, and good afternoon to all listeners.
Of course, we're talking about the strategic launch of the Disaster Risk Reduction Strategy and Action Plan for 2026 to 2030. Perhaps let's get into the importance of this strategy and what are the key strategic objectives. Let's start with Ms. Anna Marie.
Thank you very much, Juju. This strategy has developed or is launched today. Actually provides opposition Windhoek among the first local authorities in Namibia and neighboring countries to develop a dedicated municipal disaster risk reduction strategy and action plan. It's actually demonstrate the city's proactive approach to reducing disaster risks in terms before they occur, and further also protecting communities infrastructures, service, and economic activity. It also provides that framework for addressing key risks such as flooding, fire, drought, climate variability, informal settlements, vulnerability, infrastructure pressure, public health threats, and socioeconomic shocks. So it also strengthens the Windhoek's investment readiness for showing that the city understands its risks and its planning to protect infrastructure, services, and business continuity.
Interesting. Mr. Ngalombe Paulus, when we're talking about now this disaster risk reduction strategy, Ms. Anna Mary got into quite a lot of things, health, I wouldn't take away from that as well. Get into practically, what are we saying? What is it that City of Windhoek actually launched? If I'm talking to a 13-year-old, perhaps sitting beside a radio stereo right now, wants to understand, what does this actually mean? Break it down for us.
Yeah, I need the whole day to explain to you what this means. But in simple language, we are talking about basically two things.
We are talking about the City of Windhoek, this means us, the employees of the City of Windhoek.
Okay.
And then for City of Windhoek, then we are also talking about the residents. The strategies therefore want to bridge the link between the City of Windhoek and the residents in terms of how we can actually deal with issues of disaster. The strategy therefore now taken a collective approach in the sense that it takes the residents, it takes the stakeholders, and everybody around the city, including obviously the UN bodies and so on, that is a part to play in the course of building resilience. So even ultimately what we are saying, for us to be able to build resilience, we must come up with a plan. That plan has stakeholders. So whenever we face a disaster, we can then do it together. And that is what we call a strategy, because it includes everybody, including very, very important, the media, Eagle FM.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I still want us to dwell there. Disaster management. I think before we even get into risk reduction, let's get into disaster management. Now, of course, I understand that this is to reduce, right, the disasters that will happen within the capital city, right?
Yeah, basically building resilient.
Okay.
Yes, it's building resilient. My colleague will come in because there's a background for the whole thing where we're coming off and what actually led us to come up with a strategy.
Okay.
So now when you are talking about disaster management, you are speaking about hazards, different hazards. The list is unending, but one can talk about floods, issues of floods, drought, and so on, and health hazard. So now, for us to be able to break it down and to get to the core of this whole thing, you have to come up with a strategy. Risk reduction therefore comes now as an action, the activity that you are going to do to manage the disasters, basically. And then my colleague will probably just add, but the whole thing is about building resilience. Now, building resilience means that people are prepared to deal with disasters, and when we say disasters, we are talking about hazards that they are likely to face in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Anna Mary, give us background of this reduction strategy, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. The city signed up for Making Cities Resilient campaign, which is a United Nations initiative. We signed up in 2012, and in 2018, what the city did, it convinced stakeholders, and we did conducted an assessment just to assess our resilient status. What we mean by resilient status is in terms of, like, if we are hit by a disaster, how fast can we build back better after a disaster strike? So in that year, we scored around 52%, and it's simply because we did not have that technical expertise in our assessment group, and that made us to score higher. And
kindly pause for me there. So sorry, Ms. Anna Marie, just to make room for a scheduled commercial break. Okay. Keep that train of thought for me, please.
Great news! Windhoek just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before.
ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just $36 a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Okay, and we are back. You are still tuned into On The Radar News Analysis. Yes, Ms. Anna Marie, you're speaking about a particular year where you saw the figure standing at 51% of 50, and then also coming up with the strategy plan.
Thank you, Gigi, once again. So, in 2018, like I've previously said, we conducted this assessment, but with limited knowledge.
Yeah.
And also, let me say, the expertise were actually not there. So, we realized we needed to sought assistance. And in the year 2023, we sought assistance through the UNDRR Africa office. And they committed to assist the city with through the German government via the GIZ Resilient Initiative Africa. So they started, they committed to assist the city to develop their strategy. The very same year in August, on the 8th to the 10th, we convened a stakeholder engagement to conduct our assessment. A similar one that we did in 2018, mm-hmm. and that assessment consisted of community members, vulnerable groups, stakeholders, the ministries and development partners,
mm-hmm.
and NGOs. So we conducted this assessment, which took us about 3 days, and by then, with the obvious, with the technical expertise from the UNDRR and GIZ, the city then scored 18%. So, meaning that what we did in the year 2018 was probably not comprehensive.
Okay.
So now with this 18%, we needed now to develop a strategy that mm-hmm. will enable the city to fill the gaps that we have identified through our assessment. Mm-hmm. Hence, that very same year in December, we started the developing the strategy,
mm-hmm.
and we developed it together with the community and the stakeholders, because it's not a city as an organization strategy.
Mm.
Because when you are talking about resilience, it will not, it entails the whole system within the municipal area of Windhoek. So hence we started developing consultation with the community, the most affected, and in this case is the people that live also within the informal settlement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So we started that, it was not just a once-off, so we had series of consultations, and once in 2024, we also had a session where we have actually capacitated, or in terms of the subject matter, disaster risk reduction,
mm-hmm.
Principals, the councillors, and other local authorities, namely the Halawa Nafidi, Wolfish Bay, Ludred, Oshakati Town Council, and Katima Mulilo. So we convened that workshop just to build capacity in terms of the subject matter, because we didn't want to leave our sister cities behind in terms of building resilience.
Mm.
And this took place in June. And we also made these 5 local authorities to sign up to what we call the Making Cities campaign. So, and from that year, the strategy went through the processes that it has to undertake, and it was endorsed and approved by the council, mm-hmm. the Windhoek Council,
mm-hmm.
on the 7th of May 2026. Hence, we are now launching it today to raise awareness so that we can move from the just an approved document to an implementation phase where we need to implement with the community and other stakeholders to ensure that the city becomes resilient in the future and also become one of the very first resilient hub in the region. When we talk about the region, we talk about the Southern African region.
Yeah.
Because Windhoek is the very first city in the Southern region to approve or to endorse and to have to launch the disaster risk reduction. We are ahead of our
counterparts
in South Africa, Botswana, and you can name it.
So oh, really?
We are the very first one in the region.
That's quite applaudable. Yeah. Mr. Ngolombe, Paulus, now that City of Windhoek has launched the disaster risk reduction strategy and action plan, what now? What's the way forward? What is it that perhaps we can expect?
Yeah, as my colleague indicated earlier, the document that we are discussing today mm-hmm. is in twofold.
Okay.
There is a strategy, the DRR strategy, and then there's an action plan. In a process of explanation, my colleague spoke about the consultative process that we followed. In there, when we called these stakeholders together, including the community, mm-hmm. once we were done collecting this information, we did not just finalize a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
We called them back and there was a validation exercise. That exercise was basically saying, is this what you told us that we need to address?
Mm-hmm.
And it was then confirmed. And hence, now we have the final strategy. Now, when I said that there are two parts within in this whole thing, is that the strategy is basically like the strategic level, how we want to go about to do these things. The second part, which is the action plan, is the what, the activity that we want to do. It's already defined. It's so defined that it's very specific. There are objectives and there are outcomes and there are activities that we are going to do. And very, very important, who we are going to do it for and who we are going to do it with. So when you leave your office now, what we are going to do is that we basically just take the last part of the document, which mm-hmm. is the action plan, and we start to implement according to what we have already outlined in their document. And basically now what is going to happen is that because the city of Windhoek, as my colleague said, we are proud of it, is basically Southern Africa within the SADC region.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, actually, the country still have to develop a strategy. So it's going to inform actually the country bigger. So what is going to happen now is for us, we are just going to go back to the community,
mm-hmm.
take some extraction from the action plan and mm-hmm. start implementing. And as you could learn from the launch that it's a 5-year strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to break it down then into activity from year to year, what is achievable within that period of time, and we should be able to employ. The last part that I think is very, very important is that my colleague Anna Marie here is actually from a section that is responsible for monitoring,
okay.
meaning that her job from now on as a leader of that section is to ensure that these things are implemented by doing continuous monitoring and evaluation of the strategy.
Mm, so whether you're going according to plan or not.
Yeah, so it is not just going to be about implementation and having activity. It's basically also a continuous process where we are monitoring ourselves. And the best language to explain to this is quality assurance.
Mm.
Basically, this activity that we are doing, is this what we are supposed to do? Are they having an impact? Are we reaching what you said are expected outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things that we are going to look at. And everybody else then will play their role like the strategy says.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Ms. Anna Marie, you spoke about stakeholders, and Mr. Ngolombe also brought in public or community. Who are the stakeholders and what role perhaps deriving now? Of course, community is also part of that stakeholders. How do they play their part in disaster risk reduction?
Okay, Judy, thank you. I think today what you have witnessed, it's a multiple or multidisciplinary stakeholders
okay.
engagement.
Mm.
Why we had the function, why we actually invited them to this is because I think the city, in order for it to achieve resilience,
mm-hmm.
it cannot do it alone. It requires everybody
mm-hmm.
because we're talking about businesses, business continuity. We're talking about be able to enable to be able to bounce better, once disaster strikes. So these stakeholders, it's the public,
mm-hmm.
the businesses in the municipal area of Bandung, the development partners, the NGOs. Those are the partners that we are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But most importantly, the community, mm-hmm. our very, very important stakeholders
yeah.
when it comes to implementation and also when it comes to achieving this resilience, because they are, like we said, they are the most, they may be the most affected mm-hmm. when disaster strike.
Mm-hmm.
They may be the most vulnerable when disaster strike. So we are... When we developed this strategy, we ensured that everyone is involved. Yes.
Okay.
And we want now, going forward, for them to take ownership of this implementation, to take ownership of this action plan. Because the strategy is just a document.
Mm-hmm.
It has an action plan that mm-hmm. needs to be implemented in order for it to become successful.
Indeed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, to add to that stakeholders, our demonstration so that we get down to it. The most vulnerable stakeholder that we are talking about is we took it upon ourselves to invite members of the Disability Council.
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
Okay.
That is as far as it goes with the vulnerability. To be able to accommodate members from informal settlement, we took the Shack Dwellers Association. However, because Windhoek does not just exist in vain, we also then went and invite members of the Tax Red Payers Association. So when you look at Windhoek geographically, you could tell that we have basically accommodated everybody. But that is now apart from the line ministries and the development partner that my colleague was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We also included members of the academic institution. UNAM is with us, NAST is with us, and everybody that basically we could think about. So it was really a massive consultation process, and everybody was really involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And also, moving forward, I understand now when we're talking about disaster risk management, and disaster can happen anywhere within the community, I think I'm deducing that perhaps community will have obviously their important aspect to play. So in terms of awareness, where are we moving in that aspect, Mr. Ngalove?
In terms of awareness, we are basically ahead of ourselves, because today we have launched a strategy and our awareness has already kicked off thanks to Eagle FM.
Yeah.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
Myself, I'm responsible for public information and relation.
Okay.
So I am basically happy to be here already, because you actually, Eagle FM make actually our life easier.
Mm.
This is part of the awareness process that you have just kicked off today.
Mm-hmm.
We are privileged to be able to get this platform actually to kick off our awareness already.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, on every second Friday already, mm-hmm. we have already a plan that is where we are going to the community. So we are basically just going to continue. And now that we are given authority,
mm-hmm.
because we have an authority in terms of a documentation, mm-hmm. it's actually going to make it easier for us. We as employees of the city of Windhoek, annually we sign performance agreement.
Mm.
For us to make sure that we do what we promise the residents to do is to make this part and parcel of our performance agreement.
Mm.
For that, we actually get to be evaluated as well. In addition to that, as I said earlier, when we give this information dissemination, the colleagues also will further go and evaluate actually, because the whole thing boils back to the impact. We have to make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And this impact, what you are saying, is that we must lessen the effect of disaster
mm-hmm.
whenever they strike, whatever the disaster is going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically it. So two awareness is going to take place now.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the existence of the strategy and the action plan.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is the creating awareness of the possible hazards that the city of Windhoek is likely to face.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Ms. Anna Marie, perhaps let me ask you something that I to perhaps educate the public on anything that I didn't touch on that you see that it's of significance.
Juju, maybe let me just have this opportunity to actually call upon the community or the public to say, now that the city has launched this strategy, we need to work together so that we can really implement this the action plan to ensure that we become a resilient city, a resilient city in the sense that we are able to we are able to bounce back or to build back better once disaster strike the city of Windhoek. Meaning by that we mean we are prepared, we are able to prevent, we are able to lessen the impact of these disasters, and most importantly we will be able to know who are our most vulnerable communities, where are they in terms of and also the in terms of planning, because we are aware of our risks, we are aware of our vulnerabilities, and where the most important vulnerable people are in terms if there's a disaster, then we are able to allocate or focus our resources at those respective communities that are identified to be more vulnerable. So, yes, it is about we're calling us to work together as a community's business partners. Please come on board. Let's implement this. Let's make city a resilient hub for the future.
Nice. Thank you so much. Mr. Ngalombe, before I ask you to say your last remarks, something interesting is coming to my mind. Last year, South Africa faced snow, which they definitely did not expect. Is that something that we have made room for within this disaster risk reduction plan as well?
Yeah. When we spoke earlier, we spoke about the processes that we followed.
Yeah.
We also spoke about an assessment. So what we have done is that we went hypothetical and we identified the hazard that the city of Windhoek is likely to face. Right. Now, snow does not really feature for the city of Windhoek. But when you go to the strategy, it's very specific. It speaks about the hazard that the city of Windhoek is likely to prepare.
I think I'm taking it now.
Now, what it does therefore is that hazard has impact. Normally, everything else is about vulnerability. Now, the strategy helps us to have assurance and to give the residents assurance that whatever we are likely to face, we will be there to assist you, but also we are going to prepare you to deal with this one. Now, come snow, come fire, come flood, we are basically saying, this is your strategy. This is our assurance to you, the residents. So my last word to that will then be that even though if it's going to snow, to be snow, or it's going to be earthquake, acquaint yourself with this strategy, with the assessment that we have done in terms of the risk and the hazard that you are likely to face, because you yourself have a role to play as a resident of the city of Windhoek, such that when the time comes when we have to start and fight what we have to fight now, we can do it collectively because everybody's responsibility is outlined, is defined, and we already know what the outcome that we want. And it is from that angle that we are looking at this one, and then we are basically saying, prepare yourself. This is how we are going to capacitate you. This is the capacity that you need, basically.
Interesting. Thank you so much. I want to appreciate you for making time to be with me in studio, Mr. Ngalombe Paulus and Ms. Anna Marie Nipare. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's always a pleasure to
engage on this thing.
All right.
Okay. And there we had it. Of course, we're talking about the city of Windhoek launching its disaster risk reduction strategy and action plan. And of course, all of us have our parts to play when it comes to disaster risk. And perhaps in future, we'll still come and talk more on disaster risk reduction and disaster risk management is a topic that we can never really thoroughly exhaust. Nonetheless, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Our studio line is also very much open. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. That is 083-288-401. Let's pause for a commercial break. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Lipura nenge no wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite opoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuwa na onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna ebito danjika okukwetera oipindi konu konda doi nawa nene udo otukwetera o special angeta shake ngeje pa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijaweli nawa ninge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora itatu imwe mbali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa mbira hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu oma filane Eagle FM the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngelo wapungwa Eva tere ulikoni mandu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite okoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshiwana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna ebito danjuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe pa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nokumuna oijaweli nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora itatu imwe mbali heali nola natu heali mbali no heali. Ile kumberewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now today, the 26th of June, marks the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking, a United Nations observance dedicated to strengthening global action against drug abuse, organized crime, and the illegal drug trade, while promoting prevention, treatment, rehabilitation, and international cooperation. The day serves as a reminder that the global drug problem is not only a law enforcement issue, but also a public health, social, and economic challenge. Drug abuse continues to affect millions of people worldwide, contributing to poor health outcomes, family breakdown, crime, unemployment, and lost economic productivity. Now, the illicit drug trade remains one of the world's largest critical enterprises, generating billions of dollars annually and often financing organized crime, corruption, violence, and human trafficking. The increasing availability of synthetic drugs alongside traditional narcotins has added new challenges for governments and health authorities around the world. In Namibia, the fight against drug abuse has become increasingly important, particularly among young people. Authorities continue to report cases involving cannabis, cocaine, commonly known as, methamphetamine, commonly known as tick, and other illicit substances. Now, drug trafficking routes across southern Africa, combined with growing urbanization and youth unemployment, continue to present challenges for law enforcement and policymakers. And I think since the past year of 2025 and of recent 2026, we've heard common cases of drugs passing through Otambo International Airport in South Africa. And of course, that is not far from home because we have witnessed or we have heard of our loved ones right here from the land of the brave being caught in South Africa. So it is a common problem and a problem that we need to address. Health professionals emphasize that effective responses require more than arrest and prosecutions. They call for comprehensive strategies that combine both prevention, education, and early intervention, treatment services, rehabilitation programs, as well as community support, while addressing underlying social and economic factors that increase vulnerability to substance abuse. Schools, families, community organizations, religious institutions, and employers all have an important role to play in raising awareness, in supporting vulnerable individuals, and promoting healthy lifestyles. Now, as the world observes this day, governments, civil society organizations, and international partners are renewing their commitment to reducing both the demand for and supply of illicit drugs, while at the same time ensuring that people affected by substance use disorders, have access to evidence-based treatment and recovery services. The International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking is ultimately a call for shared responsibility, recognizing that building safer, healthier, and more resilient communities requires cooperation across governments, healthcare systems, law enforcement agencies, educators, families, and society as a whole. Now, the Ministry of Home Affairs, Immigration, Safety, and Security is playing its part today in terms of International Day Against Drug Abuse. Let's take a listen to that.
We should know the signs. I'm sure, I hope many of you heard the signs before, to make us better officers, not just to enforce the law as we heard by the previous speakers, but to identify our individual people in our communities who need intervention, which basically means need help. You are on the ground, you are infiltrated in our community, and you are many, many, many that can see and observe and bring the people to the help, because the help is out there. The drugs we are dealing with in Namibia, as we display here, depressants like alcohol, heroin, cannabis, especially the skunk, is now rave in our nation, and the benzodiazepines. I will come back to this one just in a bit and explain more. Stimulants like cocaine, we think it's only in other nations, but it is here, although it's so expensive. Nicotine, it was the cigarettes, and now I don't see the vapes here. Now it is the vapes, and now it's also still ecstasy. And you see my cup there. Can you tell me what was I drinking there? Enjoying the music? Coffee. Caffeine. I'm also a drug user. Caffeine becomes a drug abuse when you drink, who can take a guess, how many cups of coffee a day? Six, already an abuser. We diagnose caffeine addiction when you hit four cups a day. So you are still safe. I see some addicts in the room. Please, repent. At least just take one cup a day. It's enough. And it literally makes me high. If I drink that coffee later than 10, I cannot sleep in the evening. But there are people who are strong horses. They can drink the coffee and immediately go and sleep. So we are different. Another one is the hallucinogens, the LSD, the ketamine, and the magic mushrooms. Now, I don't know these mushrooms that we pick along the road. I don't think they are the magic mushrooms that we are referring to. But mushrooms can be very poisonous, so we need to be careful when we consume them, please. Inhalants, those years when I was still a little girl, the glue sniffing and was very popular. I don't know these days.
Let's pause here. Make room for a scheduled commercial break. Please don't go anywhere. We'll be back shortly.
Do you need toiletries and household cleaners? You won't get it cheaper than a You Save up to the 7th of June. Get 250 mm jars of Vaseline for only $25 Namibian. Smell fresh with Playboy roll-on deodorant for just $18.99 Namibian. Get 2 kilograms of Surf's hand washing powder for just $49.99 Namibian. Get 750 mm Sunlight dishwashing liquid for $28.99 Namibian. And get 2 boxes of Cares Maxi sanitary pads for only $12.99 Namibian. You Save. Where else?
And especially at the petrol stations, you see the people utilizing it, the paint thinners and similar solvents. In Namibia specifically, we are seeing the following substances most frequently in our communities in case files, like I referred to the cannabis, especially the skunk, is really stealing our future and our children. Cocaine, especially the crack cocaine. We hear our young people say, eat some more, because once you taste it, you want to eat some more and more. Mandrax, since I was a little girl, always when we walked a lot there, like at Stoffel's Bridge there, in the riverbeds, we see a lot of our people using the mandrax, and then they will fall over. It was, still a common sight where people will use it, salivate, just lying next to the pipe in the streets. Heroin, it's increasing in the urban areas, and the tick, we thought it's only for our neighbor country, but it's also fast spreading here with us and highly destructive. Now, the one which we also underestimate, like the coffee, is the prescription drugs that I said I will come around to. I see on a daily basis how people are addicted to the painkillers. What are they? Brufen. Cataflam, Edgo, Dol, Edgo Dol, Gren, Pa, the people are even importing it from the neighbor country, selling it from their houses. The benzodiazepines, these are the chill pills, the calming tablets. And they are highly addictive, and then people get prescriptions from different general practitioners, shop at different pharmacies, and the codeine, the coughing syrup. It's also found in other medication. Then, most of all, still today in Namibia, the legal substances, the alcohol. We know our situation with the shabins, the kuka shops, and so forth, and that it is a very sensitive matter because it's still a great contributor to the economy. And like I said, the nicotine, the vaping that became very, very popular and rampant, and the hubbly pipe. This is still the greatest contributor, especially alcohol-related crime and domestic violence, remain among the most common incidents still. You would know, you are the experts with the statistics in our communities and our nation that we have to attend to as a force. The damage done by these legal drugs are very, very real, and it is on a daily basis. And Namibians tend not to know how to enjoy themselves in a healthy way without alcohol, it seems, still today. It is our biggest problem still to combat. For the individual, drug abuse leads to addiction, physical dependence, mental health disorders such as depression, anxiety, and psychosis, which we say in lay terms, becoming crazy, walking naked in the street, seeing and hearing things that the rest of us don't, speaking incoherent and nonsensical things. It also increases the risk of suicide. You know the statistics of how many people just this year we have lost to suicide and also to self-harm. We call alcohol the main water because it starts with alcohol abuse. Alcohol gives us the guts, the false bravery to do those harmful things. Criminal behavior and eventual incarceration. It destroys our careers and financial ruin. How many of us, even in the force, because of substance abuse, we are bombarded with loans, we are in debt. Maybe I should do research and assess and ask for your payslips and see all those deductions from these establishments. And upon further investigation, I am sure we will see a great contributor amongst other financial challenges for these debt and loans is definitely also due to substance abuse. Family conflict and breakdown, children growing up in unstable, unsafe environments, increased rates of gender-based violence, community insecurity and mistrust, loss of productive citizens in community leaders. It saddens me, my people, that you see so many people with capacity, with potential, who is so clever, smart, and intelligent that all of that is lost. There's not anything special about me standing in front of you. It is about making sober choices and being a hard worker. Some of us are very, very intelligent, I say too clever for ourselves, utilizing that sharp mind for negativity. Please hang in there. I will be done soon. I'm so passionate, so I want to bring the message across very clearly without taking anything away from our next speaker. Why do people use drugs? Understand the psychology thereof. We are going only to intervene effectively if we understand what drives people to drugs in the first place. Policing alone cannot solve a problem rooted in human behavior and psychology. The science is clear. Certain drugs trigger dopamine, our good feel hormone, and it releases up to 10 times more powerful than the natural rewards like food, achievement, or social connection. 10 times more the good feeling than what we get from these things. The brain is essentially hijacked. But beyond brain chemistry, the most common reasons people turn to drugs are really, with our background in this nation, trying to escape stress and trauma. Drugs offer a temporary relief, escape from the pain. Social pressure and peer acceptance, especially among our young people, curiosity and experimentation. It starts so innocent, particularly in adolescence. Untreated mental health conditions. We still don't take mental illness and mental health seriously. 20 years back when I started private practice, I had one client a week and I couldn't afford my rent. At least we have grown, but we're still far in terms of our buy-in, our belief in terms of we need to take care of our mental health. You have one of the best medical aids in Africa. What is it called? CMS. Now you just donate to that CMS, or are you utilizing it to your advantage? You are paying with your blood and your sweat for that cost to company benefit of yours.
Okay, now that was Edwina Mensa Hasselman from Geluk Psychological Services, and she's the guest speaker at the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking, having commemorated today. She's an experienced clinical psychologist with a demonstrated history of working in the mental health care industry. And I guess I understand why she speaks about why we cannot just focus on the law enforcement part without actually looking at the background of why people engage in drug abuse and or substance abuse or alcohol abuse. And one of the main reasons she cited in adolescence is actually trying to relieve themselves from stress. So there's a way, obviously, with the way the economy is and adolescents going through different things, different challenges, whether social or economic challenges, they tend to resort to substance abuse and alcoholic drugs. Another important aspect that I would want to take away that she mentioned is how drugs and alcohol enhance the dopamine factor in our brain. So it increases the dopamine. Is it dopamine enzyme? I'm speaking out of correction now. Which makes it 10 times the hormone, pardon me, it's a hormone, dopamine hormone, which makes it 10 times the hormone responsible for happiness and joy, makes it 10 times more than the natural aspect. And I guess that is why people also tend to look forward to that feeling of feeling happy and not feeling stressed anymore as a result of lack of finances, or perhaps as a result of mental issues that one is going through, as a result of marital issues. So many different issues that, of course, a lot of Namibians are facing, and not just Namibians, but since it's an international day, but worldwide, what challenges that people are facing, and therefore result to alcohol and drug abuse. But this is only temporarily, and also it has its damages. It brings its damages both to the brain and eventually to the body. But nonetheless, what I would encourage any of us is to book ourselves into mental institutions, not necessarily so that you can be accommodated to be there, but social mental institutions can also be social worker offers, knocking on their door and speaking out about your challenges. If you're perhaps not comfortable to engage some of the people that are closer to you, perhaps you want to keep it not secretive, but private. Maybe you want to keep it private. Therefore, there are those that are equipped and trained to actually deal with such issues on a professional level. And I think the fear has always been, what if they lock me up? They would listen to you and give you the best advice. And she also spoke about how some of those who have SEMAS medical aid can actually afford to do this, but then they don't do it, and then you suffer in silence. And as you hear, some of the people that commit suicide, government employees. Now the question might also come in to say, did they perhaps at one time attempt to go out and seek counseling on a professional level? Nonetheless, this issue or this conversation of mental health can never really be exhausted enough. Therefore, continuous discussion around it has to continue. Nonetheless, this is On the Reading News Analysis. We cover topics from all corners of life, whether social or economic aspects. But nonetheless, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace, make room for a scheduled commercial break. We'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you. My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Welcome back, and now let's get into economic indicators before we head over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Now, $1 today is equal to 16 Namibian dollars point 44 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equal to 4 Namibian dollars point 48 cents. One Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars point 35 cents. And €1 is equal to 18 Namibian dollars point 75 cents. One Chinese yuan is equal to 2 Namibian dollars point 42 cents. And last but not least, one Botswana pula is equal to 1 Namibian dollar point 21 cents. Now let's cross over to South Africa for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Cape Town police issues a stern warning ahead of June 30. Let's hear what they have to say.
Particular says enough police officers will be deployed across the province, including in rural areas. He's urged people to act responsibly and said police will have zero tolerance for acts of violence.
No arms are allowed. If you march, you don't have to have a stick. You don't have to have anything. You just march. That's all. And you don't hide your face, because we want to see your face. If you talk about traditional issues or religious issues, then don't go to the march. If you have that choice that this is your traditional weapon or it's your religious choice to have the mask on yourself, don't get to the march, because we're not going to allow you.
But Akile says the duty of the SAPS, as with any protest action, is to ensure the safety of the citizens and protect property, among others. He also urged communities not to spread information that may cause panic and said police would not hesitate to invoke the Cyber Crimes Act.
You are not allowed, even if you found something that's been posted to you, to forward it to somebody else. In other words, you are now distributing that same information. So we urge people not to make themselves guilty by just reading it. If you see that this thing has a potential propensity to cause panic or incite violence or instigate other people to commit crime, then don't distribute further, because you are also now furthering that crime.
Patekile is preparing to retire on the 30th of June, and he oversaw the last medal parade of his tenure as Provincial Police Commissioner. However, he says, he will remain on duty in the run-up to and on the day of the expected march.
On the road, you will see me everywhere. I'm not going to disappear. You remember, this is a national interest. It is interest of the citizens of the country, not my own interest. I really wish that I go peacefully and the citizens, they behave peacefully so that I don't have to come back and make other statements. Because you're going to be asking the same question just the following day on the first. On what capacity are you now responding on that? I don't want to do that.
You know, President Cyril Ramaphosa urges for calm and respect of rule of law ahead of the Plains protest march against illegal immigrants on the 30th of June.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says undocumented migration remains a significant challenge with implications for social cohesion, security, and the provision of public services. He also addressed concerns about the possible disruptions linked to the anti-illegal migration campaigns planned for the 30th of June.
We are ready to deal with whatever disruption, instability that could take place. I'm a strong believer that South Africans are peaceful people. They are not xenophobic. They are not Afrophobic as well, and they want peace. They just want every day of the week to go on a peaceful basis without any disruption of their lives, disruption of services, and any danger to the life of anyone. So on the 30th, as people are saying, all manner of things will happen. We are taking measures to ensure that the 30th becomes a normal day where people will be able to work, to go about their business. Our security forces are ready.
The president says security agencies are prepared to maintain law and order. At the same time, government is looking to strengthen the criminal justice system through the work of the Madlanga Commission, which is investigating allegations of criminality, political interference, and corruption within the law enforcement structures.
The Commission of Inquiry into Criminality, Political Interference and Corruption in the Criminal Justice System, which, as you correctly say, is chaired by Justice Madlanga, is expected to submit its final report at the end of August 2026. The findings and recommendations of the Commission are expected to shed light on the alleged corruption and infiltration of the South African Police Service and other organs of the state. Most importantly, we expect that the Commission findings and recommendations will bolster our efforts to strengthen our law enforcement capabilities. Now, the work of the Commission is already having a huge impact.
Ramaphosa says the Commission's work is already making an impact. He also acknowledged concerns about tensions among senior officials within the security cluster and says measures are being implemented to restore cooperation and public confidence.
A number of steps are being taken to stem the instability within our security forces, and particular amongst the key officials, and a number of processes underway to ensure that all the key officials in our security agencies work in a cooperative manner and they put aside what could be seen as vengeance against each other and focus on the task at hand. The task at hand is to fight criminality. The task at hand is to root out corruption and to ensure that the criminal justice system and entities in our country regain the trust of our people. And we have determined that all senior officials in our security entities should go through lifestyle audits. That is a rigorous process that is currently underway. And whilst I would like to give clear timelines, vetting processes and lifestyle audits do tend to take time, but they are being done. And as they get concluded, those that are found to be involved in various nefarious activities will be dealt with.
Midvale Local Municipality is set to spend 41 million rands on roads infrastructure.
In a time when most Gauteng councils are buckling under debt, Midvale Local Municipality in Gauteng is pushing money into the ground. Literally. Thus, as Executive Mayor Peter Tiexera announced that 41 million rand has been budgeted for road infrastructure in the year ahead. That builds on 190 million rand that has already been spent over the last 5 years. Tiexera spoke to the SABC on the sidelines of the Midvale State of the Municipality address on Thursday.
It will never be enough, for the road network that we have in Midvale, but 41 million rand will be a good start for us. This is the biggest road budget that we've put together. This is to address some of the challenges that we have on our roads. And with this budget, there'll be new roads that will be converted from gravel to tar.
The announcement also follows the spending of 20 million rand, which was used to electrify Stella Extensions 4 and 5 dwellings, a place known for Izinyoka connections.
We've got conditional grants that are available, for example, the housing projects in Stelo that we need to deliver. So what we are doing is, you would have heard in my speech, we're going to continue the electrification of Extension 4 in Stelo, that you're looking at around 20 million rand of electricity infrastructure. And the same in Savannah City, we continue with the substation there. It is a massive project, which is over 60 million rand that we need to complete in the new financial year.
But there are complaints from Sotelo residents that the municipality deducts 60% from their electricity purchases, a move that kicked in 5 years ago as the community wasn't paying rates or taxes.
That's part of our credit control and debt management policy that we implement very strictly. We are saying that if you have a genuine issue and you are in arrears with the municipality, come and talk to us, let's make a payment arrangement.
However, the people at Sotelo bemoan the policy.
That directive only applies to the owners of the houses, not those whose parents have since passed on. They want a letter of executorship, which is something we cannot afford.
This thing affected it too much because right now...
And this thing has affected us quite a lot because we have children who go to school. And most of the time we don't have power. It really affects us.
Even us, we are affected.
On the same wavelength, the municipality is also planning a rollout of informal settlements upgrade program alongside the Gauteng Department of Human Settlements. And unlike other municipalities in Gauteng, the mayor says Midvale prides itself on not owing Eskom or Rainwater. Recently, several Gauteng municipalities appeared before the South African Human Rights Commission, where it was revealed that they collectively owe Eskom and Rainwater over 30 billion rand. Nomvuyo Ntanjana, SABC News in Midvale, Gauteng.
Meanwhile, the European Union boosts Ebola funding drive.
The numbers reveal a massive wave of commitments, but a complex financial picture. International donors have so far pledged $910 million to fight the Ebola outbreak. And African governments have mobilized approximately $80 million. Sounds good, right? But health experts say just $90 million have so far been received by the affected countries. One expert says transparency is a key factor.
African institutions and countries, on the other hand, need to set up transparent healthcare funding system that allows international organizations to have the confidence to release these funds to them so that we can have KPIs that match funding in a sustainable manner.
To close the financial gap, The African Union is pushing for a bold self-reliance initiative. The continental body is seeking to mobilize at least $100 million from domestic governments and the private sector.
I call upon our continental partners to continue to stand with Africa in a spirit of solidarity and mutual responsibility. We welcome the bold actions being undertaken by the World Bank to free up capital for the response. We call on all financing institutions to be as flexible and understanding in this hour of need.
But without immediate cash on the ground, there are growing fears that health teams could lose their race against the virus in real time. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN.
And as you heard rightly there, the African Union has launched a multi-million dollar resource mobilization campaign in order to contain the escalating Ebola outbreak. Now, the outbreak has largely been concentrated in the northern easter of DRC Congo and parts of Uganda. Although nearly $1 billion has been pledged globally, African leaders are urging governments across the continent to increase domestic contributions. In other news, delivery services drive Ethiopia's digital economy.
Only a few years ago, ordering food, groceries, medicine, or other everyday goods online was not a big part of daily life for many people here in Addis Ababa. But now that's changing, and it's changing fast.
Delivery services were not very common in our country before, but now they are becoming increasingly popular. Our sales to walk-in customers are decreasing, as more business is now happening online through platforms like Telegram and TikTok, and demand for delivery services is growing.
The growth is mainly driven by fast-expanding digital payment systems, growing adoption of technology, and the transformation of the city's road infrastructures. Companies such as Click, powered by Chinese-made electric bikes and charging technology, are helping push the sector into its next phase.
Businesses, whether selling food or other items, can now easily reach customers anywhere in the city. Our system handles everything from item listing to pricing, payment and delivery. Our fleet uses electric bikes, which are cost-effective and environmentally friendly. This also aligns well with our country's policy of shifting toward electric mobility.
While the sector still faces some challenges, such as the lack of standardized street addresses in some neighborhoods, experts say it has registered strong upward growth and is already playing a key role in facilitating trade.
This has been grown, especially after COVID-19, because people are working at home and also some restriction to be at the public places. Home delivery is important if it is coordinated. One is in the promotion of trade. At the same time, I think it creates also labor opportunities.
Besides facilitating online trade, delivery services have also created employment opportunities for hundreds of young people.
I've been working in the delivery business for 3 years. When I started, delivery services were not very popular and there were fewer orders. But now delivery has become popular and many people use the service. A lot of young people like me are doing this work. It helps us connect with many people while also earning an income to support our families.
It started small with food delivery and grew into the movement of goods for businesses. And as the city modernizes and technology adoption grows, delivery services are becoming one of Ethiopia's fastest growing urban industries. Beka Atoma, CGTN, Addis Ababa.
Port Sudan has resumed its cargo transport shipment operations.
The arrival of transshipment cargo at Port Sudan marks the return of a trade activity that had been largely absent in recent years. Transshipment allows goods to be transferred from one vessel to another before continuing to their final international destinations. make imports important links in global supply chains. Sudanese port authorities describe the development as a significant milestone, saying it reflects renewed confidence in the country's maritime operations, despite the ongoing conflict.
Efficient cargo handling has earned the trust of traders and shipping lines. Expanding transshipment operations could generate significant revenue for Sudan by handling and re-exporting containers destined for other countries. Sudan's strategic location is a major advantage. The Southport container terminal lies near the midpoint of the Red Sea, between the Suez Canal and Bab al-Mandeb Strait, making it an attractive hub for international shipping lines.
Port Sudan's strategic location on the Red Sea has long positioned it as a gateway connecting Africa, the Middle East and beyond. Officials say the return of transshipment services could generate additional revenue, attract new shipping lines, and strengthen Sudan's role in regional trade. Authorities acknowledge that improvements will be needed if Port Sudan is to expand its shares of transit trade and compete with other hubs along the Red Sea corridor.
We have significant opportunities in this sector to handle cargo from many countries, and now activity has begun to pick up again. The return of Sudan's national maritime carrier after years of suspension is expected to boost state revenues, expand port operations, strengthen trade links with African and Middle Eastern countries, and support Sudan's economy by enhancing maritime transport and supply chains.
For now, the resumption of transshipment operations is viewed as an important step toward revitalizing one of Sudan's most critical economic assets.
Whether that momentum can be sustained may depend on the country's ability to modernize infrastructure, improve efficiency, and reassure international shipping companies that Port Sudan remains open for business. Neba Muhiddin, CGTN, Port Sudan.
Let's now hear on Africa's biggest dam is running. So why are millions still stuck in the dark? As Ethiopia built Africa's biggest dam, but more than half its people still have no reliable power. Now the surplus is flowing south to Kenya, instead where a growing tech economy needs exactly what Ethiopia has to sell. Let's take a listen on what DW has to offer.
Economic transformation. So why are millions of Ethiopians still living in the dark? And what does that tell us about it? Ethiopia has built Africa's largest hydroelectric dam, doubling its power generation and fueling hopes of an economic transformation. So why are millions of Ethiopians still living in the dark? And what does that tell us about a challenge facing much of Africa, getting power from the source to the people who need it? We'll be speaking about what it will really take up to light up the continent. But first, this report from DW Sello Oneko and Esheti Bekela.
This is Africa's and Ethiopia's biggest hydroelectric dam. And these are the people hoping to one day benefit from its power. Ethiopia's government promised the dam as a ticket to a modern future. Yet almost half of all Ethiopians still live in the dark. In a small village in Ethiopia's southern Gedeo zone, this firewood is the only form of fuel Workinesh Negusia has. Her village is not yet connected to the national electricity grid.
We survive using firewood. We don't have anything else like charcoal. We used to have charcoal, but now it's become very expensive.
Workinesh is a mother of four. Her children urgently need light in their home to study after school.
It's affecting their ability to study. How can a student study at night if there's no electricity?
And Workinesh's family isn't alone. Over 60 million Ethiopians live without access to power. That's almost half of the population. Yet Ethiopia's government has big plans to expand its grid. Launched with much pomp and to an audience of regional leaders, Ethiopia opened the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, or GERD, in September 2025. Built as a symbol of national pride, this dam was mainly financed by Ethiopians, including many ordinary citizens. That was largely because potential international funders were pressured to stay out by Egypt, which feared it would get less of a share of the Nile water. Now that the dam was built, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed stressed that it would not only benefit Ethiopia, but the entire region.
For our brothers in the countries downstream, Ethiopia built the Grand Renaissance Dam to prosper, fill the region with light, and change black people's history.
With a capacity of 5,150 megawatts, the dam has doubled Ethiopia's energy generation. Now, the challenge is bringing power to remote areas like Workinesh's village.
Until about 7 years ago, it wasn't more than 44%. However, we've now reached approximately 54%. The ongoing grid-related work will enable us to increase this to around 78% in the coming years. We're also working on off-grid solutions.
While international backers like the World Bank have pledged to back this grid expansion, analysts believe that it's ultimately up to Ethiopia's government to connect its people to the grid. And as researcher Tom Lavers points out, while the dam might be the answer to generating more power, it certainly wasn't a direct ticket to a modern future.
The challenge of meeting universal access to electricity, which remains the government's goal today, is an extraordinarily difficult one. A country the size of Ethiopia, with a population that is as dispersed as Ethiopia's is, with generation concentrated in places where the majority of the population don't live.
While the dam may not yet be powering all of Ethiopia's households, its regional effect was more immediate. Ethiopia started exporting surplus power to Kenya and Djibouti, a welcome addition to the still emerging regional power pool. And for Ethiopia, a bit of income to maintain and finance all of its new infrastructure, including the expansion of the power grid. The power is transported via a 1,000-meter-long high-voltage line from Sodo in Ethiopia to a substation in Suswa in Kenya.
Here in Suswa, about 100 kilometers away from Nairobi, is where the electricity from Ethiopia ends up and is fed into the Kenyan grid. The amount transmitted at the moment is still very low, but both countries are hoping to expand on regional connectivity.
Similarly to Ethiopia, Kenya has big ambitions to grow and scale its economy. In Kenya, 75% of the population is already connected to the grid. The power is sometimes faulty and unreliable, but unlike Ethiopia, Kenya only has a few last connectivity miles to go. Currently, Kenya relies on a mix of geothermal, wind, solar, and water. Over 90% of its energy comes from renewables, and yet when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, or when drought reduces water levels, the amount of power Kenya generates is barely enough to keep its economy going. So it needs a reliable backup source.
Meanwhile, Venezuela earthquake's death toll rises to 235 as the search for survivors continues.
We begin the program in Venezuela, where officials say at least 235 people are now known to have died in Wednesday's powerful back-to-back earthquakes. Large numbers of people are still unaccounted for as rescue teams try to find survivors in the rubble of collapsed buildings. These are live scenes coming to us from the capital, Caracas. The second of the quakes was the strongest in Venezuela since 1900. The country's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, said that her government's absolute priority was to find as many survivors as possible as she visited the worst-hit area, the state of La Guardia. Joe Inwood has our report.
In La Guardia, whole blocks reduced to rubble. The city, a scene of destruction, devastation, and despair. For people like Carolina, who cannot find her son.
The only thing I can say is that I have my heart in my hands and I don't know what to do.
I ask God for all of us, because this is something that there, where you see that, nothing. I don't know where he is.
And this was the moment on Wednesday evening when two major earthquakes struck in quick succession. The first magnitude 7.2, the second 7.5.
I started hearing massive thunder sounds, and by the time I looked around, everyone else that was outside of the boxing ring I was in was already crowded under the pillar and supports and started screaming. The earthquake lasted what felt like a really long time. It felt like about 30 seconds. The local people there were screaming for God to save us.
The town of La Guaira on the coast was worst hit, but the capital, Caracas, was also badly affected. There, chains of people formed to help clear the huge piles of debris and search for survivors. Venezuela is a poor country that has suffered from years of economic mismanagement and corruption. The acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, has promised that heavy machinery and aid will get to the affected areas as soon as possible.
And we are now declaring a state of emergency, as provided for in our constitution. I want to thank the governments of the world that immediately after these earthquakes occurred, contacted Venezuela to offer solidarity and support.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program brought to you by Peniambeko Jonas. From Indafa, Happy Juju, it is goodbye. I'll see you again tomorrow on Saturday from 1900 hours up until 2100 hours. That is for life lessons. Ensure that you tune in. Have yourself a wonderful weekend and drive safely.